Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. School equity officers, or liaisons, what are they? What do they do, and why are they needed? Whether at school or in the workplace, the position of equity officer has become more popular or mainstream, and frankly needed for many organizations, which have struggled with diversity, equity, and inclusion. Case in point, the Sacramento City Unified School District. Two racist incidents last year have been the tipping point, and now the district has hired an equity officer with the hope that race relations can improve across district campuses. CAP Radio race and equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan joins me now to discuss this position at Sac City Unified and why it's becoming increasingly important to see these positions pop up across the country in big cities as well as smaller communities. Hey, Sarah.
Great to be here, Vicky.
So this is the district's first race and equity liaison. Remind us, why are they creating this position?
Sure. So as you mentioned, this position was formed specifically to help address two of the district's most publicized racist events, one involving a teacher saying a racial slur during a class at Kit Carson Academy back in May, and another involving a student writing a racial slur multiple times on the parking space of West Campus High School's vice principal, who is African-American. The superintendent, Jorge Aguilar, says this position will help to increase transparency of the investigations that the district is conducting around these two incidents, but they have really specified at this point that this new position is specifically to look at these two investigations.
Well, given that this is a first ever position, what went into the selection process for this position and who ultimately was selected?
Of course. Yeah. So ultimately, they've chosen Mark Harris. He's an attorney and advocate who runs an organization. Some folks may be familiar with it in Sacramento called LEAD. So that's Law Enforcement Accountability Directive. He's a longtime civil rights lawyer who says he's committed to making sure these investigations lead to a certain level of transparency in the process. Here he is.
Our community is calling for accountability. It has not had a very clear vision as to the fact and factors associated with these incidents of racism that the superintendent spoke of. So I want to make sure that I enhance the transparency relative to these issues. It's up to the superintendent and the board to then discipline the perpetrators of these acts. So the accountability portion really is in their hands. I'll give advice and counsel on that, but that's within their wheelhouse.
Right. And accountability is the big word here, and that is in the district's hands. So what is Superintendent Aguilar saying about the creation of this new position?
Yeah, the superintendent says he knows that, of course, this is not a one-off solution to the issues at Sac City. Here he is.
I think that there are ways in which a role like the one that Mark Harris is going to be playing for us is also part of a larger strategy to demonstrate to our community that we are going to continue to lean in and we are going to continue to address these issues with the degree of seriousness that I think our students and our faculty, staff, and community deserve.
But he did also say that, you know, the district does have a priority on addressing these two investigations that already kind of have the ball rolling. You know, I think that there is a chance that there may be some office of equity that's created in the future. But for now, I think essentially the district wanted a third party person who was not the board and not the school district to oversee the investigations and kind of, in some sense, make sure that the district was making the right steps once the results of the investigation come in. But, you know, he also says he's very hopeful about this position being appointed. Here he is again.
So in some ways, we see ourselves as an equal partner in trying to address systemic racism, not just in our schools, but throughout our entire community and beyond. So we are committed to making sure that we address it internally, though, as I said, from a boardroom to a classroom philosophy that will involve professional development. We will continue to enhance our training of all students or all faculty, our staff.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio race and equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan about Sac City Unified hiring its first race and equity liaison following racist incidents on two campuses last year. Are there already other school districts or cities that have a similar officer liaison like this?
Yes, absolutely. So it turns out having a specific administrator who is full-time and who deals with issues around race and equity is becoming much more popular in school districts across the country. It's important to note, of course, that for Sacramento City Unified, as we've kind of mentioned already, Attorney Harris's position is limited in scope to looking at these two incidents of racism. But it isn't inconceivable that the district may eventually create a more full-time role. You did hear the superintendent just talking about other training activities and professional development opportunities he'd like the district to have. And it wouldn't be out of the ordinary to see that somebody specifically dedicated to overseeing that would be hired. And lots of other cities like Oceanside, California, Atlanta, Georgia, and Washington, D.C. All also have equity officers that are full time. I spoke with Mary Rice Booth. She's the Access and Equity Officer at the Leadership Academy, which is an organization that trains educators based in New York. Here she is.
Especially since the murder of George Floyd, there's definitely has been a position that has expanded greatly since then. What you can see is about 100% of the largest, 25 school districts in the country have a chief equity officer and somebody in that role. And it has definitely been somebody that continues to expand. So even you have smaller districts across the country who are taking on that role in different elements.
She cautioned, however, that using the equity officer position as a band-aid to fix immediate harm that's been done is not often a successful approach.
I think that's unfortunately usually the impetus for creating the role, right? Something has happened and you need to respond to it as a community, right? I think what's the challenge with equity officers, number one, this role cannot be done alone. And it is not the answer. It's just a part of the equation of actually moving a community to seeing things differently.
Well, I guess going off that, is there skepticism that this role, this new role in Sac City Unified is just merely symbolic and won't lead to actionable change? What are you or are people overall optimistic about the new role?
Absolutely. So I know that, a lot of folks have mentioned that the Sac City Unified is not even getting someone who's kind of going to look specifically at the overall culture within the district. This is a very targeted role that they're hiring for. I'd say that, as Mary Rice Booth just mentioned, this isn't a position that can operate in a void. To the district's credit, they have said that this is not the only action they plan to take regarding these racist incidents. But I also spoke with Carl Pinkston. He's the president of the Black Parallel School Board. That's a community organization that works alongside Sac City Unified. And he expressed a lot of concern that just Sac City Unified is working against a legacy and history of racist incidents happening, and honestly, against just the legacy of racism within the United States as well. Here he is.
They need to have a department, someone who understands race and class in the educational system and move all parties in that direction. That includes administrators, it includes custodians, it includes teachers. Everyone wants to blame the teacher, but no one wants to blame the system. And the system is often headed by board members and superintendent. And the superintendent and board has to be held accountable.
And he also echoed sentiments that he hoped this liaison would not be alone in trying to solve issues around racism in the district. Here he is one more time.
I do want to make perfectly clear, hiring a liaison is not the solution. It is just a piece, a part of the process. The concerns that parents and community have about the incident that took place at Kit Carson and West Campus is both the nature of the educational system, but more importantly, the community would like to see some accountability, some justice.
And of course, we heard earlier from the superintendent that he's promising that the equity liaison would not be the last step the district takes to address racism. But I also very much got the sense of frustration and exasperation from Pinkston, who said he just wasn't feeling optimistic that the district was going to make the right steps to address racism as a whole in the future, in part because there have been so many long simmering issues that have just gone unacknowledged for so long, is what he told me.
And Sarah, I mean, you mentioned that this new officer, this new position is investigating specifically two racist incidents at campuses. Is there a timeline of when this investigation will take place? Because is this more of like a contract position?
Yeah, I think this is a contract position, although they could not tell me when his position would be ending. Essentially, I think he's just going to see these two investigations to their very end. They were able to tell me that in terms of the West Campus incident that happened back in November, they're moving very quickly on that one. And that I believe they said they'll have an update in the next few weeks, though they could not specify what type of update. So we should be hearing more about it shortly.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for the update.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Vicky.
That is CAP Radio race and equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. Up next, UC Merced professors are learning how climate change impacts the most vulnerable communities across the San Joaquin Valley. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As the side effects of climate change intensify, the impact is hitting the world's most disadvantaged communities the hardest. This includes some of the poorest communities here in California's Central Valley. According to California's Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, more than half of the people living in the San Joaquin Valley, stretching from Bakersfield to Stockton, live in disadvantaged communities. Hundreds of thousands of them face water insecurity, poor air quality, increased risk of heat strokes due to rising temperatures. A new study led by UC Merced is shedding light on how climate change is exacerbating all of these issues, spanning 8 counties and more than 4 million residents. Although most of the study's key findings are concerning, the university is also developing solutions to potentially lessen these impacts. Here with us to lay out some of the key findings and solutions is one of the scientists who contributed to the report, Dr. Joshua Veers, professor of water resources management at UC Merced and director of the Center for Information Technology Research in the Interest of Society. That focuses on creating IT solutions for society's most pressing challenges. Dr. Veers, thank you for joining us on Insight.
Good morning, Becky. It's great to be here.
Yeah, before we dive into this report, share a little bit about your background and what brought you here.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, I'm a professor in our Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UC Merced. For your listeners that may not know, we're the 10th and newest campus of the University of California system. We've opened our doors in 2005. To about 400 students. We're now at like 9,400 students, and we're very excited to build the future of this state in the heart of California. So our students come from all over the state, but predominantly in the San Joaquin Valley, the focus of this segment. 88% of our students are from underrepresented groups, and 3 out of 4 are first-generation college goers. I bring expertise in water resources management, having worked at UC Davis for a number of years, where I did focus on watershed sciences and climate change and impacts to both our communities and to our ecosystems.
Well, given that you came from UC Davis, you're now at UC Merced, two different regions in California. This report is among 12 separate climate change assessments for the state. The San Joaquin Valley is actually the final region to be published earlier this month. You have the Central Coast, the Inland Desert, Los Angeles, the North Coast, Sacramento Valley, San Diego, the Bay Area, and the Sierra Nevada. With your lens, what is unique about studying this region?
Yeah, that's a great question. And certainly there are a lot of commonalities throughout California. You know, as the fifth largest economy in the world, we're highly dependent on each other. And we're all facing the same challenges with respect to a warming atmosphere. So the uniqueness about the San Joaquin Valley is that we're the agricultural heartland of the state, if you will. So we're one of the most productive agricultural spaces in the entire United States, if not the world. There are a lot of dependencies, however, for us to bring water from other parts of the state, principally the Sacramento Valley and certainly the Sierra Nevada. And we're also home to, as you mentioned, a number of disadvantaged communities throughout the region. It's a big space, and it's connected to a lot of other spaces. So water flows into us and flows by us. And that agriculture is highly dependent on water, as you may imagine. So we look to the Sierra Nevada and its watersheds to be able to supply that water, as well as to the Sacramento Valley. And certainly we're connected to the rest of the state, in part because we're providing the food.
Right. In the study that you contributed to, it says that the San Joaquin Valley experiences one of the most challenging environmental and socioeconomic conditions in California, despite really being the agricultural economic anchor of the entire country. Why is that?
Well, there is certainly a paradox that you're pointing to there, that, you know, we're incredibly productive from an agricultural perspective, but persistently poor. Part of the reason for that is, you know, kind of long-running systemic issues with respect to rural communities and being, you know, disconnected from basic services like drinking water. And affordable and clean drinking water remains a persistent issue for these communities that may be spending a disproportionate part of their paycheck just to buy water. So these are things that are long recognized. And it's, you know, the feedback loops with respect to climate warming can be, directly impacted in terms of exposure to extreme heat days. So one of the findings from the report is that, in effect, by end of century, we're looking at 10 times the number of extreme heat days. So these are days that are over 102 degrees Fahrenheit. And so going from historically what might be 4 days in a given year to nearly 40 throughout the region. And so anybody that's traveled throughout the San Joaquin Valley during the summer, especially in August, you know how hot it can get here. Imagine each and every day and having to work outside, perhaps that's in, you know, as a farm worker in agriculture, construction, et cetera, that amount of exposure can certainly debilitate health. And then moreover, we were able to show that that cooling at nighttime isn't going to happen nearly as much or as often. And that requires us to run air conditioning around the clock nearly. That's going to increase the cost, not just to people's checkbooks as they pay for the increasing energy cost, but as we know, without a clean energy future, we're just going to be emitting more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and thus exacerbating the problem that we face today.
Yeah, I mean, we're going from 4 days to 48, that's tenfold. One of the metrics I'm curious about in the report, it says 55% of those living within the San Joaquin Valley live in disadvantaged communities. What, it, by definition, is a disadvantaged community, and how did you come up with the 55%?
So the definition for a disadvantaged community has to do with gross income, and those are defined by the census place that's associated with each one of those. So we use the standard definition both for disadvantaged community, and they even have severely disadvantaged communities. As it turns out, of the number of census tracts and the number of people living in those, it's over 2 million people in the San Joaquin Valley, of which there are about 4 million. So it is about 55% in total count, and also about half of the census tracts. Again, these are often very small communities, though even a city like Merced might qualify as a disadvantaged community.
And again, we're talking about this under the umbrella of climate change. And given that the report is centering on climate change, what surprised me is how drastically different the ecosystem is now and is among the most degraded in the state. Can you help us visualize that?
Well, as your listeners may know from, you know, fourth grade California public school education, is that California was much different 150 years ago prior to the gold rush. And the San Joaquin Valley was a vast inland wetland for the most part. It's relatively flat and it doesn't drain very well. So when the big torrential snowmelt came off of the Sierra Nevada, it would enter into the valley and it would slow down and spread out. And that flooding, if you will, would percolate into the local aquifers to the point where there were natural springs and there were vast wetlands. And if you go further south towards Bakersfield, Tulare Lake was once one of the largest inland lakes in North America. Since then, we've transformed that landscape. We've drained the wetlands and we've reconfigured our rivers, and we try to get those floodwaters off of the landscape. And in the process, we converted much of that land to agriculture. So we've lost 95% of our former wetlands. Now, that said, we try to manage the wetlands that we do have and the native ecosystems that are in the San Joaquin Valley to try to maintain those ecosystem services. And we're actively looking to not only preserve those ecosystems through levee setbacks for floodplains, but actually to work with agriculture in such a way that this managed aquifer recharge can take place when we do have those floodwaters. So it's a change in thinking, and it may require a change in how we use our land going forward.
Right, because agriculture needs water. How is climate change already impacting, you know, one of California's most powerful economic engines? I believe in the report there was discussion of evapotranspiration, if you can.
Evapotranspiration.
That in layman's terms for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one of those terms that you probably got in 11th grade science class.
And went in one ear and out the other for me, clearly.
Yeah, that's right. So the E in ET is for evaporation and the T is for transpiration. And so the evaporation is the amount of moisture that's leaving the soil, and the transpiration is the amount of water that's leaving the plants. So in agriculture, even native forests and grasslands, we think of evapotranspiration as the loss of water from the land to the atmosphere. And as it turns out, this evapotranspiration tax, if you will, from an increased warming atmosphere is pretty substantial. And some research that is to be published, it isn't quite out yet, but the results are really startling. And that was that the 2021 water year, which just concluded, was not only one of the most driest on record, but was certainly the highest when it came to that evaporation demand. And that was 2.5 inches beyond anything that we'd measured before. And to think about that in real terms, right? So 2.5 inches and 5 million acres of agriculture in the San Joaquin Valley, that's roughly 1 million acre feet. And an acre foot is about the size of a football field that's a foot deep with water, and it's also the size of some of our largest reservoirs. So for listeners in Sacramento, that's about the size of Folsom Dam and all the water behind it. And that's just the amount of water that the atmosphere now needs because of the increase in temperature.
If that continues or intensifies, what solutions are out there to mitigate that?
Well, Vicki, it's a race against time. I think everyone really recognizes that. We need to change how we do things and to, you know, not just change how we, you know, drive our cars, which is certainly part of the issue, but to really think about a clean energy future. And that's the, you know, the full transition and decarbonization of agriculture. So getting dirty diesel out of our tanks and thinking about new ways of doing things with lighter tractors that running on solar power with batteries and so forth. But beyond that, we need to think about what we call regenerative agriculture. So this is capturing more carbon out of the atmosphere and storing it for long periods of time in our soil. And we can do that through cover cropping and through changes in practice for our orchards and our fields. All of that is going to require that we reconfigure how we approach these problems, and certainly it's going to have some effect on our economy. So we're looking for these win-win solutions. And one example of that is that the California Department of Food and Agriculture recently funded something we call the Fresno-Merced Future of Food Initiative. And that's really bending these advances in technology and engineering around climate smart agriculture, but also bringing our disadvantaged communities to be part of that solution. So we want to make sure that the inventors of the tech aren't benefiting from that innovation, but the users of the tech benefit from it as well.
When you say that there will be an economic impact, what kind of economic impact are you talking about?
Well, I think we've already seen, this connection of what we call the food, energy, water system is that we're having some impacts to our infrastructure, With respect to subsidence. So we're heavily dependent on groundwater, and our ability to navigate in a climate warming world is impacted by the fact that we're experiencing what many call climate whiplash. These are periods of prolonged dry or drought that are punctuated by pronounced wet. And so we get these incredibly wet years like 2016 or a flood like in 1997, and our infrastructure is not well developed to deal with that. And so the mix between groundwater and surface water utilization has led to an over-reliance on groundwater, and the over-pumping of those groundwater aquifers has led to subsidence, and subsidence has in turn impacted our canals and aqueducts and our bridges and our riverways. And so we're having to spend more money on that infrastructure to remedy these problems that inevitably are linked to a changing climate.
The report, when it's talking about climate change and all of this, it also discusses the impacts, which include education, access to grocery stores, healthcare, even sidewalks. So how does this factor into the conversation?
That's absolutely correct. So these feedback loops that sometimes we don't really think about is that with a warming atmosphere and a change in rain and snow mix is that our forests are drying, and a warmer atmosphere makes them more susceptible to disease outbreaks, as an example, and that in turn makes them more susceptible to catastrophic wildfires. So we've seen these extreme events happen, large areas with catastrophic wildfire that have impacts on our air quality because of the smoke. And we're now seeing a disproportionate number of days of our kids not being able to go to school because of air quality. So these are examples of these feedback loops that most people don't really connect to a changing climate, but inevitably are going to get worse as we move forward.
Given that this is the fourth assessment of this region, and this is obviously your wheelhouse, what surprises you about this most recent report that was published earlier this month?
What surprises me most, and I tend to focus on water issues, and we can get pretty deep in those, but just how interconnected everything is. And that isn't just, in our society and thinking about both metro areas and rural communities throughout the San Joaquin, but even within our state, things that happen elsewhere impact us, and things that happen in the San Joaquin impact others. And so just the sprawling nature of this, if you will, is something that certainly startled me. Now, that said, I was also, I don't want to say relieved, but certainly encouraged by the idea that everyone's starting to take notice that this is something that's going to require an all hands on deck approach to fundamentally change how our society works going forward. And I think we can be a leader, not just for the state, but also for the rest of the planet.
When talking about interconnectedness, what about living with kind of the unexpected? We're in our third year in a pandemic. How does this factor into climate change and the impact on specifically the San Joaquin Valley?
Well, I think what the pandemic certainly exposed, and most people recognize this when they went to the grocery store and saw the empty shelves, right, is the entire supply chain is affected. And our frontline workers, particularly farm workers in the San Joaquin Valley, were disproportionately impacted by, having to go to work and not being able to do that under, ostensibly safe working conditions. I think that's improved certainly, but something we need to look out for. And that is that our economy is built on the idea that you can go to the grocery store at any time and pick up any produce that you want. And we've certainly benefited from that, but it may not be the case going forward. And so we may need to adjust our expectations and certainly look out for those that are on the front line. I do think there's an opportunity going forward to think about, the jobs of the future. And as we think about our workforce and getting people out of dirty, dangerous jobs for low pay. And there will be opportunities as technology inevitably filters into, what we call the digital transformation of agriculture. And, with that in mind, I want to point to a recent study that a student at UC Merced conducted as part of her doctoral studies. And that showed that covering our canals and aqueducts with solar panels, in fact, saved a little bit of water, which we were hoping was the case, but actually was more efficient in producing energy from the sun because of that evaporative cooling. right? And that meant that the return on investment for making that was that much better. So I think there are some win-win solutions out there. So when we're thinking about what we call the food, energy, water nexus, we're, you know, moving water to irrigate food. In this case, we can actually generate some energy along the way.
That is really interesting. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're learning about a new report out of UC Merced focusing on how climate change is impacting the San Joaquin Valley and what solutions are out there. You mentioned that you specialize in water resource management. Obviously, we're starting to see more precipitation in the form of rain. The snowpack has been dwindling over recent years. That's not necessarily a good thing. What impact will climate change have on really what the water future for specifically the San Joaquin Valley?
Well, it's multifaceted. I mentioned previously that the water balance in our forests is incredibly important. You know, we're highly dependent on what happens in the upper watersheds of the Sierra Nevada. And so that rain-snow transition line is certainly moving up in elevation. And the further up the mountain you go, the less surface there area there is for snow to fall. And so we anticipate less snowpack into the future. What that may mean is that we have to operate our reservoirs a little bit differently, with the idea that we have to be able to, most of our reservoirs are what we call multi-purpose in the sense that they're providing, you know, flood hazard risk reduction, they're providing recreation opportunities, they're providing hydropower, which is part of our clean energy portfolio. But they also support downstream communities and farms and native ecosystems. And so we have to finely tune how we operate those. Critical to being able to do that is understanding, you know, what the future looks like. And so we're talking about forecasting. And that's where some advances in artificial intelligence, coupled with some of our satellite remote sensing, is really, you know, helping us better understand what we have in terms of being able to quantify the amount of water and when we might be able to count on it. You know, so you can't manage what you don't measure. And we're trying to make strides both in the measurement and the management side of things.
Yeah. I mean, even earlier this morning on CAP Radio's morning edition, you know, California's even just almond industry is like $6 billion. And we talked about how, you know, the San Joaquin Valley is really this agricultural anchor for the entire country. So how can agriculture help combat climate change?
Well, that's an excellent question, and thanks for bringing that up. So, you know, as was mentioned, there are just over 1 million acres of almonds in the state of California. It's one of the largest agricultural footprints, if you will, and therein lies the opportunity. It's one of the places that, you know, I think we can work with industry to perhaps fine-tune how we do agriculture, and that's around precision irrigation. So, you know, providing the right amount of water at the right time for these million, you know, acres of almonds. But part of being able to do that is understanding how much is being used. And so there's a consortium out there that recently unveiled a new data product. It's called OpenET. Remember, the E is for evaporation, the T is for transpiration. So OpenET is filling the biggest gap in our water knowledge. That work is led by Environmental Defense Fund, Desert Research Institute, NASA, Google, and others. And I think it's going to go a long way towards helping scientists such as me understand what we're up against, but also the individual grower that may just want to know how much water is coming off of their farm.
Great. So from a going really from cerebral to practical as well.
Yeah, that's right. So just being, you know, as I mentioned, you can't manage what you don't measure. So in this case, being able to measure with great accuracy and precision how much water, what we could refer to as consumptive use, how much water is leaving the farm. And so when we know how much water is being delivered, the applied water, and that's either surface water through our canals and aqueducts, or perhaps it's groundwater, a combination of the two, we have a better sense of how much water is going into that savings account, if you will. And so as we look to what we call managed aquifer recharge, so this could be purposeful flooding of fallowed lands, it could be stormwater retention ponds, it could be injection wells, a number of different ways. We have to be able to account for those stores and fluxes of water, both on the water, you know, on the farm and the farmscape, but also the irrigation district and throughout the region in the San Joaquin Valley.
You know, going off of and just kind of, yeah, springboarding off of the interconnectedness of everything. When people talk about sea level rise, we mostly like look towards the coast, you know, like San Francisco, Miami, New Orleans. But how could that have an impact on Delta communities?
Well, I think most people don't realize this, but as you drive from, you know, Sacramento to Stockton, you're more or less at sea level, right?
Right.
Sometimes it's hard to know with all the trees and the levees and everything else. But the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta is this amazing maze, if you will, of waterways and sloughs and islands. And all of that is at sea level. And that is challenging because with sea level rise and tides coming in from San Francisco Bay and perhaps high runoff from the Sacramento River, is that the water surface elevation can get quite high up the edges of these levees. And it just takes one small crack or fissure in the levee wall for water to be able to penetrate it. Ultimately, it could result in a, you know, catastrophic failure. There's enough land or space behind these levees to accommodate sufficient water out of the delta that it actually draws brackish water or salt water from San Francisco Bay into the delta. And the problem with that is it not only compromises drinking water for those communities in and around the delta, but those are where we have the intakes for our largest aqueducts that are moving water south to about 20 million people in Southern California, as well as about 40% of our agriculture. The potential for catastrophic failure in the delta is quite high. Mm-hmm. And that's why it has both scientists and water managers, you know, quite worried about how we deal with that.
Well, let's try to end on a high note, on a silver lining. I mean, because the topic of climate change often feels overwhelming and hopeless, but you're also talking about solutions in this conversation. I guess, finally, what gives you optimism?
I'll get to the optimism. I think adaptation is certainly underway. You know, climate change isn't something that's going to happen in the future. It's what's happening now. And we're starting to make some adjustments, some of them quite visible, others, you know, most people don't think about. For example, we're starting to grow coffee in California. That's a subtropical crop, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, it's just kind of interesting to see how humans adapt. What gives me hope certainly is the next generation. All of the, you know, the students at UC Merced, climate change has been part of their entire lives. And they're highly attuned to that fact and active about wanting to be part of the solution. And we're seeing that, you know, across the different majors. It doesn't matter if you're in, you know, biology or engineering or perhaps even philosophy. I think we're you know, tackling this as an existential, you know, threat to civilization, for which it probably is.
Well, as we just covered, it affects all of us.
That's right.
Thank you so much, Dr. Veers.
It's been my pleasure, Vicki.
Dr. Joshua Veers is a professor of water resources management at UC Merced, sharing the findings of a study on how climate change will impact the most vulnerable communities across the San Joaquin Valley. Still ahead, after 36 passionate years, the co-founder of Sacramento's B Street Theater is bidding adieu. Buck Busfield joins us with a look back and what's in store. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. A transition is coming to the B Street Theater Company this summer. Producing artistic director and co-founder Buck Busfield will be retiring. Buck has been with the theater company since its creation back in 1986, when he and his brother, actor Timothy Busfield, started the Fantasy Theater, a touring theater for children. The brothers expanded the company years later as the B Street Theater. Over the three decades that Buck Chuck has been part of the theater company. There have been many transitions from moving to a new venue, not to mention a global pandemic, and now his retirement. Joining us to talk about the many things he has seen over the years and what he looks forward to in his retirement is Buck Busfield. Buck, welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Vicki. How are you?
I'm doing great. And, you know, I guess congratulations on this chapter and embarking on a new one. Why are you retiring and why now?
Great questions.
Imagine it's bittersweet.
It is. It is. I'm going through a lot of the natural kind of apprehensions and excitement, all that stuff. But basically, you know how dog years are 15 for one human? Running a nonprofit arts is about the same. So though it's been 36 years, it feels like 136 or more. It's just, you know, you only have so much you can do. And I feel like I've done it. I'm 70 and I feel like I've lost a little bit of a step. I'm still very excited, but I think it's time to turn the theater over to a younger set of leaders that have maybe a slightly different vision or a new vision. Now's the time. We have this gorgeous new facility, the Sofia Coppola Center for the Arts. It has three beautiful performance spaces, a beautiful bar, lobby, rehearsal areas, and it's a gem, and it's ready to be delivered, I think, now in a fresh way.
You know, going back to the very beginning, when you really created theater for children across Northern California with the Fantasy Theater Company, you know, what did you see that was lacking? Because clearly there was a big gap, and you actually served, I think, millions of children over that time.
That's true. And first of all, it should be said, Fantasy Theater was 100% my brother's brainchild. He's a creative genius and an inspiration to me, and he was the one who had the real passionate vision to bring professional theater to kids, because his belief was, and this is true, is that theater is a delicate art. And if kids don't see a good experience early, they might not enjoy it or come back later as adults. So he felt that the earliest years were the most important. We still feel that. And so he started the theater in 86 and asked me to come out and help, but he's to blame.
Have there been moments in the 36 years where you've seen, you know, things come full circle, where maybe a child that was really influenced by Fantasy Theater maybe 36 years ago is now in theater and is now an actor or is in that creative environment because of that influence?
Absolutely. And that really is the most gratifying part of the job. When you see it come full circle, not just as actors, but as audience members. We have so many people that come to see shows or plays or music or dance or whatever, and they say, oh, Fantasy Theater came to see me at my school in Sac City or whatever, Lodi, and now I come here as an adult. So that means that our, you know, missions, you know what missions are. It's language, and you hope that your actions and results can match your lofty mission goals. And so when that happens, it actually confirms and validates the mission.
Hmm. How do you reflect on the past 36 years? Are there certain moments that stick with you more than others?
No, it's a blur of you just putting one step in front of the next and holding your palms up and out and having wonderful people help you. It's just never stopped. Every time we were in trouble financially, which is often for a nonprofit arts organization, go to the post office and a check would come, or somebody would do something kind or donate something or do something in kind for us, or we'd have a hit show, God knows why. And so not really, it just doesn't. Now there are chapters. There was the Fantasy Theater chapter, then the B Street chapter. We added family series, we had a B3 series, summer camp, then we built the Sofia. So those chapters are there, but it does feel like just a straight line.
Well, when talking about challenges, walk us through all the decision-making that went on during the pandemic, especially in the beginning in 2020 to then reopening to audiences once again during something that was just so unexpected.
Yeah, everyone deals with stress differently. I really shut down and don't feel much until later. And so I kind of just got into business mode and didn't really, you know, I kind of shut down and just put together a plan to keep as many people on payroll as we could. We didn't want to lay off everyone, but also keep some money in the bank and just try to wait it out. And then what happens, as you know, it always costs a lot more to start up a business than to operate it, because your income isn't coming in yet. So we reopen in the summer, and partially, and then we had to we're not closed now, but we had to cancel a couple shows, and now we're reopening again. So what you're doing is you're starting a new business again and again.
Yeah.
And that's the real struggle. You know, okay, I've brought people back twice now.
Wow, twice now.
Yeah.
You know, I look at the last 3 years, or just life in general, a lot of times is improv. It's like, yes, and you kind of just have to, you don't know what's coming, but you got to go with it. And the fact that y'all have done that is just remarkable. With all the productions that you've done, do you have any favorites?
I do. And I must kind of tell you that this impending transition succession has caused us to do a lot of studies, national studies. And it turns out we're the most prolific arts organization of our size in the country. We did 900 performances the year before COVID.
Wow.
So we've done just thousands. And as you said, we've served so many kids and just done so many plays. But you know, I think one of the things B Street Theater does is we present theater that's accessible and sprinkle it with really tough stuff that's not so accessible, rather than bringing the inaccessible stuff to the forefront. So we'll do comedies, and the comedies are the ones that I remember most of all, Around the World in 80 Days, The Big Bang, so many, The Underpants. But then the drama, I must say this, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? It was a phenomenal production. And so that one's memorable. Yeah.
What do you see for the Sophia going forward?
Yeah, well, we have, we have the board. We came up with a dual leadership plan. So we're going to have, I'm the producing artistic director, which means I oversee the business and the art, and we're going to divide that and have an artistic director and a business manager of equal leadership. And Lindsay Birch, who's been with us for 10 years, is going to step into the artistic portion. And we're doing a search with AMS's help, consulting for a managing director. And what I think will happen is because the organization becomes so much more complex because of the finances, and now we've added music and theater, or music and dance and podcasts and comedy and all this stuff, you're going to see more of an emphasis on financial stability and sustainability, and the art will continue as it always has.
How are you going to accomplish that financial stability?
Well, when we get back to where all of our income, the revenue cylinders are firing together, we've not had that yet since the closure. The hiring of this managing director is going to really focus on that. And that's something I frankly don't have a lot of time for. And I'm not very good at. And so, you know, we have auditors that tell us you could do better here and do better there. So the first thing we have to do is shore up our business and accounting and make it the best it can be. And then we'll reevaluate.
What advice do you have for, you know, the people that will be taking over?
Well, we have a love affair with our patrons, and, you know, you can read every book you want on business and management, entrepreneurism, and all this stuff. At the end of the day, it's the people that we love and love us. And I mean it sincerely. We know so many people that come. We have this enormous loyal subscriber base. And I would say the most important thing is you've got to create a real bond of affection with the audience. I'm going to speak less about how you do that, but that's the most important thing. If you don't do that, then you're just a movie house, you know, and here's a new movie. I didn't like it. I walked in, I didn't see anyone I knew. But when you come to Sophia, we want you to see people you know and connect with them. So that's the most important thing. Start with that connection.
Right. Like, feel the community, you know, and yeah, that's so important. It's intangible. When you retire this summer, what are your plans? Are you still kind of mulling it over? Are you actually going to sit in the audience now?
With my yellow pad, taking notes, you mean, critiquing the show? No, I'm going to stay on. They've invited me to stay on as a board member, and I'm going to be for a while you know, a few more months after the summer in some limited capacity on staff as a consultant. So I'll be busy. I'm also going to direct plays, write plays, and do some workshops and try to work. But I'm gonna relax for a little while.
Yeah, a little bit of decompressing. It's well, yeah. It's well deserved, well earned.
Yeah, I'll be interviewing you about this in about 40 years or so.
Oh, okay. Well, I look forward to that. Thank you so much, Buck, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And
Appreciate it.
Is Buck Busfield, co-founder of the B Street Theater. Buck will be retiring this summer after 36 years. Well, kind of retiring. He's still going to be busy. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zen, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.